Oh, say can we see by the one light in all our earth to embrace at the call of all nations where our children can play in a world without war, where we stand hand in hand in the grace of creation, where the rivers run clean through the forests of green, where the cities stand tall in the clear skies of freedom. Oh, say do our hearts sing out for harmony and love forever on the planet of our blessed with peace on earth.
Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org, or you can listen to this program and previous programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com, or notices of new programs, you can friend me at Facebook. Today's program includes Inside Job. I saw the movie Inside Job, and I highly recommend it. It was directed by Charles Ferguson. He also produced No End in Sight, a documentary of the Iraq War. He was interviewed by Adam Leshefsky, who is a senior editor at Fortune magazine. They ask if the economic global meltdown of the last few years could have been prevented. His documentary, Inside Job, makes a powerful case that an out-of-control finance industry took advantage of the deregulated atmosphere and purposefully sought to get rich at the expense of others. And then after that, Policing America's Empire. Al McCoy, a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and author of the most recently award-winning book, Policing the American Empire, United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State, talks about how empires are maintained and why the U.S. empire is in decline and what the consequences might be depending on how we respond to that decline.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight's program is also being held in association with the San Francisco Film Society. I'm Adam Leshefsky, a writer with Fortune magazine and your moderator for today's program. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Charles Ferguson, Academy Award winner and documentary filmmaker of Inside Job. To say that Charles Ferguson has had a varied career would be a gross understatement. A math major at the University of California at Berkeley, he later earned a PhD in political science at MIT. As an MIT postdoc, he researched the intersection of high-tech globalization and government policy while serving as a consultant to several federal agencies, including the White House staff. In 1994, he founded the software firm Vermeer Technologies, which created FrontPage, a pioneering website development tool. Just 2 years later, but well before the internet bubble, he sold Vermeer to Microsoft and embarked on a career as an author and filmmaker. His first documentary, No End in Sight, The American Occupation of Iraq, was released in 2007 and provides a scathing appraisal of the Bush administration's conduct of the war. For his second film, he turned his sights on a fiasco of a different sort, the 2008 financial crisis that nearly brought down the world's economic system. That film, Inside Job, was awarded the Academy Award for Best Documentary Film of 2010. In his brief acceptance speech in Hollywood 3 nights ago, Ferguson noted that not one high-level person has yet gone to prison for their role in the crisis. Please join me in welcoming Charles Ferguson. Charles is going to say a few words to get things going. No gavel knocking for you.
No gavel knocking. And let the record show that I'm wearing jeans. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I will just say a few things. First of all, it was a remarkable experience to make this film. I started thinking about it actually fairly early on because, in a way, indirectly related to my earlier academic and policy career, I know several of the people who were among the earliest to warn about the coming of this crisis. Nouriel Roubini and Charles Morris, who are two of the people who appear in the film, are people I've known for quite a while, and in 2007 they began talking to me about this, telling me that something really quite serious and dangerous was going on, and that at some point it was going to end, and possibly end catastrophically. And I began paying rather close attention to them when major financial institutions began failing on a weekly basis in 2008. And it was after the failure of the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers in mid-September 2008 that I decided that I really had to make this film, and I approached Sony Pictures Classics, who were immediately very supportive. And by early 2009, we were already in production and filming. So, and the making of the film entailed a great deal of research, and in some cases, the two things coincided in the sense that I frequently learned very surprising things in the course of conducting the interviews that make up the film. The aftermath, however, is a little more depressing. You know, I have to say that like many people, I think, I was initially very optimistic and hopeful that when Barack Obama was elected president that he would do something about this, and I think that he had a historically, politically extraordinary, unique opportunity to do so as a result of the country's condition, the mandate he had, the overwhelming majority of his party in Congress, the sentiment of the country and the population. And it was enormously disappointing when we saw him appointing as his economic and regulatory team the same people, a group of people, many of whom had contributed to causing the crisis, some of whom had done extraordinarily unethical things. A couple of whom, you know, arguably should perhaps even be subject to legal sanctions. And unfortunately, his policy measures subsequently have been consistent with that economic and regulatory team. Today, the Securities and Exchange Commission did vote to adopt new and substantially improved regulations with regard to the control of executive and trader compensation in the financial services industry. But the measures they adopted were fairly weak, and in general, overall, I would have to say that I would give the Obama administration, you know, kind of a C- with regard to handling the situation. So with that,
good. You recently gave it, right before you won the Academy Award, you gave an interview to the New York Times, and my favorite part of this interview was when you were asked, it was suggested perhaps some of the people who you interviewed and had heated exchanges with in the film may not be so happy about their portrayal in the film, and your response was, too bad. Could you elaborate on that, please?
What part of too bad didn't you understand?
I got it, certainly. But I'd like you to explain, if you would, the documentarian's process or the journalist's process of how it's not your responsibility how they feel about having been portrayed badly. In other words, how did you get to be such a tough guy is what I'm asking you.
Hmm. Well, I've been one for a while, actually. Partially, perhaps, the way I was raised, I don't know. When I was an academic, you know, certainly it was quite routine to get into tough fights, intellectual fights, not personal ones. But, you know, people were very direct about their views of each other's ideas. And also, I had the benefit of a PhD thesis advisor who was a remarkable man who had done real things in the real world. He'd been Deputy National Security Advisor for the Kennedy administration. And I remember one time when I complained to him that I was under a lot of pressure. And he kind of smiled and he said, "Well, Charles, let me tell you about the Cuban Missile Crisis." That's pressure. Your problems are not pressure. So, you know, he set a high standard. And also, you know, for my first film, I spent a month filming in occupied Iraq in 2006, which, you know, was not a garden spot, to put it mildly. And so, you know, the idea of Glenn Hubbard getting angry at me didn't exactly terrify me.
Very early in Inside Job, I can't remember if it's you or if it's Matt Damon as narrator, says this was not an accident. I think that's sort of the critical statement of your film. Would you explain what that means, that the financial crisis of 2008 was not an accident?
What I meant by that, and I think there's rather wide agreement on this in the relevant analytic community, was that if you set up a financial system that has incredibly dangerous incentives and you don't have any regulatory oversight of that system, then you're going to get dangerous behavior. And so it shouldn't come as a surprise if people do things that end up causing a major financial crisis. So I would point in most particularly to two practices in which the financial sector engaged, both of which it still engages in. One is the extremity of the leveraging of these financial institutions. They fund themselves using very short-term funding. They make very long-term, very illiquid investment decisions. And they borrow enormous amounts of money. At the height of the bubble, Lehman Brothers had a leverage ratio of somewhere around 35 to 1, meaning that a 3% decline in the value of their investment portfolio would lead them to be insolvent, and that's dangerous. So, first of all, that kind of institutional behavior. But I would say even more importantly was the structure of personal incentives. People were given enormous short-term, primarily cash, but whether cash or stock, it almost doesn't matter, enormous short-term incentives and rewards for doing things that had enormous long-term consequences, and if those things went bad, they paid no price whatsoever. And if you know, if you're going to have a system run like that, and furthermore a system run without regulatory oversight, then you're going to have crises.
So in the first case, leverage ratios are down considerably at all financial institutions in the United States. And in the second, so that problem, whether by fiat or not, has been dealt with for now. Okay. On the second issue, what would you do? Whose salaries would you regulate in the financial systems? Everyone's? The top X number of people? How exactly would you write the regulation or legislation to solve this problem?
Well, certainly you would regulate the compensation of top management and boards of directors, where boards of directors are also important. Director compensation in this industry is far from ideal.
So you'd cap it at how much?
No, you wouldn't cap it. You would regulate it. And you'd also regulate the compensation of anybody who had the capacity to take major risks or cause major damage, high-level traders who have high limits, things like that. Look, you know, when I started my software company, it was funded by venture capitalists. And when they decided that they wanted to invest in the company, they sat me down and we had a little talk. And little talk went like this. Charles, your salary is going to be $100,000 a year. It's never going to go up. You will never receive a bonus. You will not have any outside income. Your stock will vest over 5 years. You cannot sell a single share of it, ever, until the company is liquid. So, Charles, go out and make your stock worth something. Well, if we had compensation structures like that in the financial services industry, I think we'd have very different behavior.
So since you spent so much time on this, I want you to linger on this and drill a little more deeply. You don't want to cap it, but you want to regulate it. So you want some regulator to write regs that would give guidance to a Goldman Sachs on how to structure a trader's compensation.
Yes. Yeah, more than guidance. I think that this is so important that this should be more than guidance. So what should it be like? Well, a very high fraction of their compensation should be deferred for a significant period of time. The SEC regulations voted on today defer 50% of compensation for 3 years. That is not enough. This bubble lasted 6 years, at least. Some people would say 7 or 8. And 50% isn't an impressive number either. So compensation should be deferred. A high fraction of compensation should be in some form that brings direct feedback with regard to the consequences of that person's decisions. Some banks in Europe, for example, have begun compensating people with the same financial products that they create and sell. And...
This is the eating your own dog food form of compensation?
Yes. Uh-huh. And, you know, I think that it has a great deal to recommend it. And also, where the compensation is in the form of stock, it should be stock that you have to hold for a significant period of time. And if you do something wrong, it should be taken away from you.
So in the case of your venture capitalists, the reason they had so much power over your compensation is that they owned the company. Metaphorically, they invested. They were the owners. They called the shots. They told you what to do. Your suggestion here is taking power away from the owners, who are the shareholders, and putting it in the hands of regulators. So I'm going to ask you a question that is, I'm meaning to be half serious and half devil's advocate with you. Isn't this un-American? Isn't this anti-capitalist, what you're suggesting?
No. Well, there is perhaps a sense in which it unfortunately is, but that is in its response to the extremely uncapitalist behavior of the people who have been running the financial services industry. If the people who ran the financial services industry behaved the same way as Silicon Valley venture capitalists, we wouldn't have these problems. But they don't. And there are a number of reasons for that. I wouldn't pretend, actually, to understand this completely, how over the last 20 years, the financial services industry has come to be captured by its employees, its senior employees, as opposed to shareholder representatives who would want to behave much differently.
Yeah.
But there's also something else that's very important. We actually do very tightly regulate compensation and many other aspects of behavior, even far more intrusive than compensation, in industries that are dangerous. We don't let ordinary individuals own unlimited quantities of high explosives.
Yeah.
We don't let just anybody fly a 747. And if you fly a 747 when you're drunk, you get fired. And you don't just get fired because the airline fires you. You get fired because the FAA doesn't permit it. And we have to understand the financial system is like that. If a financial system goes down, then consequences are really very serious.
A few quick topics before we go to audience questions. First of all, TARP. Was TARP a good idea, and in your opinion, did it work?
Well,
and I'm sorry, maybe you would just speak for 20 seconds on what TARP was for the benefit of anyone who doesn't remember that acronym.
TARP stood for a Troubled Asset Relief Program. It was the $700 billion effort to stabilized the financial system during the crisis of 2008, in part by directly injecting capital into financial institutions, in part by purchasing some of the securities that they owned but could not sell. Certainly, it was necessary to use a great deal of money to stabilize the system. Unquestionably, that was an extremely urgent necessity.
So you're willing to give the Bush administration and the Congress credit for that step that they took?
Yes, at least for part of it. There are two things, however, about TARP and more generally the Bush administration's response to the crisis that were and remain very troubling. The first was that all of the assistance went to basically the top 0.1% of the population. So there was very little assistance to people who were suddenly losing their jobs, losing their houses, losing their assets and their wealth because of the effect on the stock market. And those effects were extremely severe, very severe. During the latter months, the last months of the Bush administration, unemployment in the United States was increasing by more than 0.5% per month. And so, you know, over 500,000 people a month were losing their jobs. And that's, you know, not good, obviously. And very little was done to help, you know, the bottom 75% of the American population. That's the first problem. Second problem was that this assistance was given without any serious requirements in return. So nothing was done to curb investment banking bonuses, for example, which in early 2009, at the height of the crisis, actually set records, which is, you know, pretty amazing when all of these companies are on life support and unquestionably would have failed without federal support. They pay out billions of dollars in cash bonuses.
Well, in fact, they also were required to pay out billions of dollars in dividends to the investor, namely the government. I mean, it's not that nothing was required of the banks. These were structured in the form of investments in the form of loans, which had coupons.
Yes, that's true. So the government got either an interest rate or, in a few cases, a dividend. But that was quite minor relative to the other effects. And regardless of their comparative size, you know, if the signal that you're trying to send is that you want to reform the financial system and prevent this kind of thing from happening again, that signal was not sent. In fact, the signal that was sent was exactly the opposite, which was you're free to continue doing this, and you'll pay no penalty for it.
So on the subject of reform, you are dismissive of Dodd-Frank. It's essentially, I'll paraphrase, a useless piece of legislation that doesn't achieve reform. Is that your perspective?
That's a bit too strong, but you know, what grade would I give Dodd-Frank? You know, maybe a C-, which, you know, up from an F, that's an improvement, but you know, is it an A+? No.
So you're not impressed with the Volcker Rule, not impressed with some of the things that have been in the news in the past few days about things that will have the effect of raising the percentage of down payments on average for insured mortgages. There will be thousands of regulations written as a result, including in the next few years, but it's not enough.
Most of the regulations have not yet been written, is the first comment to make. For most of the areas covered by the bill, there's a study period and a period for the formation of regulations, drafting of regulations, comment on them, promulgation of them, which lasts from 1 to 4 years. So only in a few areas have regulations actually already been put into place. Many areas are potentially covered by these regulations, but they are reversible in the first place. In the second place, the ones that have been put in place, you know, I would not say that they give me a great deal of comfort. They might prevent exactly the same crisis from happening, but another bubble in a different market with a few tricks, you know, I'm not at all convinced that we have prevented this from happening again in another 10 or 15 years.
So long, Mom, I'm off to drop the bomb, so don't wait up for me. But while you swelter down there in your shelter, you can see me on your TV. While we're attacking frontally, watch Brinkley and Huntley describing contrapuntally the cities we have lost. No need for you to miss a minute of the agonizing Holocaust. Yeah! Little Johnny Jones, he was a U.S. pilot, and no shrinking violet was he. He was mighty proud when World War III was declared. He wasn't scared, no siree. And this is what he said on his way to Armageddon. So long, Mom, I'm off to drop the bomb, so don't wait up for me. But though I may roam, I'll come back to my home, although it may be a pile of debris. Remember, Mommy, I'm off to get a commie, so send me a salami and try to smile somehow. I'll look for you when the war is over, an hour and a half from now.
And now for something completely different.